Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up, it's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's August 9th, 2013. You're listening to the best poker cast anywhere. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
And we are on the mainland.
Yes.
Back home, safely. Took a long time.
Yeah, I really don't understand how. I mean, we could pretty much swim from the Dominican Republic to Tampa, but it took us 12 hours
to get there. Yeah.
How does that work?
I tell you, when you're in an airport that's basically only protecting you with a thatch roof, things tend to take a long time sometimes. So.
See, and that's why they hit you for $10 every time they come to the country.
Hey, at least they didn't charge me $20 to get out. That's although if I did pay $20 to get out, we would have gotten through that line a lot faster than we did. So maybe I should have. I don't know. But yes, we are back. The World Championship has wrapped up. We are very pleased with all of the feedback and how things played out for us. The main event, we have a new world champion. His name is Don Bates. And we are very happy that he came from locally. He came from our Sarasota Kennel Club, our good friend Sam Minatello's room down there in Sarasota, Florida. And he won in one of our satellites. So that always makes you feel good that, you know, we provided this opportunity and one of our players won it. So and you really got to pick up the story in our September issue and read it because it really is kind of a cool story. I mean, he wasn't even supposed to play in this thing. So I always love those kind of stories. When the guy's like, you know, it's kind of like, I never played the lotto. The one time I played, I won. You know, it's kind of like that. But great main event. Surprising ending to me. I thought that a couple other players were going to run away with it and ended up being our friend Don. So very cool. And it was a long final table.
Unbelievable.
And they still had to make a deal at the end.
Yeah.
Who knows how long it would have been. And that's, of course, you know, a credit to Sam's structures. Everybody just gushed over the structures. They were very generous. And slow. I mean, maybe that's something that we shouldn't have because you know, this thing took 14 hours. This main event final table. And
you know, it's a funny thing. I talk to players all the time about this. You know, they all went, "Hey, we want more ships, longer levels, blah blah blah." And then when tournament directors give it to them, they're like, "Oh, come on! I gotta be home to see Matlock tonight.
Yeah,
this thing's going on too long."
Yeah.
So, and not always the same players. I mean, obviously they're you know, there's a reason that poker rooms plan a 3 or 4 hour tournament nightly. And it's not that they want to screw you out of your money or anything like that. It's just that they know most of the players in the daily tournament want to get in and out.
Yep.
But at a big event like this, you know, people, you know, spend a lot of money flying down the Dominican. You know, they want to get some good value up for their play. What was interesting to me, though, is, of course, it's a really good structure in a resort that you would want to be off doing other things sometimes.
Well, and that explains some of the smaller numbers we had in our day tournaments because people were just, you know, they wanted to enjoy the beautiful weather, the beautiful beaches, the incredible pools. I mean, they had 15 pools or whatever. I mean, it was just ridiculous how massive this resort was. So it's totally understandable that the numbers in the daytime were low, but still respectable considering how many players we brought there. And then at night, you know, we filled up. The room was buzzing every night. And you know, if they ever told you, "Oh, our room's always this busy," they'd be lying because we were really buzzing and we really added a lot to it. They added 5 tables to the room just for us, so it was really cool and it was a really nice resort. You know, 7 days for me was too long. I think you could see everything in about 5 or 4, but still, it was a good time and the poker there was pretty remarkable.
Most remarkable is I added cash.
When they find out the cash, they'll say it's not remarkable, I'm sure.
Certainly not proud about this, but I did finish runner-up in a 5-player event. But hey, a cache is a cache, is it not?
Well, it's funny.
It's not like I won a satellite, which is not a cache, you know. So
for the whole week, everybody was calling you like Bubble Boy because you had bubbled on a tournament. And then when it was five-handed, I said, hey, you think you could possibly bubble this too? And it's funny because they were supposed to pay one spot, but you made a deal. Otherwise, you really were the bubble because you finished second. But yes, you have another Antioch Poker Tour cash, a five-player tournament. Congratulations. Something to be proud of.
Oh, it is. My Hinden Mom page, I looked at it yesterday after they got the result posted, and it's impressive. Seven caches, six of them under $100. So... people are just going to steer clear of Scott Long when they see me coming.
Man, that's hilarious. Well, I of course, everyone knows I don't like to play tournaments. And I like to enjoy the daytime as well at this place. So I didn't play any of the tournaments at all. But I did play the cash games. And I can't recall, when you went down the last time with Sam to check out this place, did you talk about how wild the cash games were on the show?
Yes, I believe we did a whole show really dedicated just to how crazy it was. So I should have directed you go back to listen to that before you went down so you could better prepare yourself.
It was brutal. You whatever you said, you were right, and you probably didn't even do it justice because that's how crazy this it really was remarkable. I am a firm believer, I really am, that if we lived there, we could make a living there.
Mm-hmm.
It's that bad. It was that bad. Nobody ever believes you if you have a hand. And then even if you don't even have that good of a hand, you can count on their hand being worse. If they you can't bluff anybody here. The only people you can bluff are tourists who watch poker on TV and understand that they probably shouldn't call here or whatever. But other than that, every single time somebody would go all in and somebody would call, neither would have the nuts.
Right, yeah.
I mean, it wasn't even close. And I watched hours of play because I didn't play in the tournament. And I didn't actually play cash games so the second to last night there because I wanted to make sure that, you know, I would have money. I didn't want to be bored out of my mind, you know, at the end of the week. So I wanted to make sure in case I started going broke with these wild players or whatever that I would be able to keep playing and rebuying. So I wanted to wait till the last possible day. And so I watched. And I can give you a real quick hand. I couldn't believe there was a raise preflop and four callers. I think it was four. It may have been three callers. And the flop came 7-7-4, and three suits. So the initial raiser shoved. The first caller called. The second caller called. The third caller called. And they were all in at that point because the guy under the gun had the most money, the guy who had the initial raiser. So... down there, they make you turn the cards up. You can't just keep them down and then muck them. You have to turn them up. They always say, open them up, is what they say. So the initial raiser had raised under the gun with ace-queen offsuit. And remember, the flop was 7-7-4. He shoved, which even it's not even really that bad of a play if you know, they have to assume that you have aces or something there, or they can't call without a 7 or whatever. So, and the raise was like $35, and it was a 1-2 game with somebody $4 straddled in that hand. So the guy raised at 35 preflop, by the way. I forgot to tell you that. And then these stacks were all like 200 to 300. All right. So ace-queen, next hand, ace-king. Ace-king calls the all-in. Okay. Next hand was king-seven offsuit. So they called a $35 raise, and they weren't in the blinds. They called it cold with king-seven offsuit. Had flopped three sevens. And the final guy who called the all-in was pocket eights. So... granted, you can imagine a hand where the pocket eights would be ahead, but can you imagine three hands where the pocket eights are ahead, and you called off your entire stack? So it went blank, and then a king, and the guy made his full house kings and sevens. So I, when I saw that, I said, okay, yeah, I'm going to wait a few more days to play, because I just couldn't believe it. I didn't know what else to do. I mean, how could you... okay, ace-queen, fine. Going all in after the flop, whatever. You're showing strength. You showed strength pre-flop, whatever. But the ace-king and the king-seven pre-flop, really? And then the eights? Really? I just couldn't figure it out. So all I did was play the basically really big hands and value betted whenever I had value bet, whenever I had, a hand that deserved it, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
My biggest hand was I had pocket aces under the gun, only time all week. And I raised to like 16, and it was a 1-2 game, and I knew someone would call. So a guy called. And then another guy re-raised to like 40, so I shoved. I had like, I don't know, 200 and something in front of me, because I wanted to isolate the guy because he had like 90 behind or something. Well, the guy who called my initial raise calls the all-in, and then the other guy who had raised calls. Well, I was up against, I had queens, but the guy, the original raise caller, had jack nine. I mean, jack nine. He put $190 in on jack nine preflop. After I had raised, he called the raise. Another guy re-raised, and then I shoved. He called with jack nine. And, of course, I won. And that was the type of hand that was, I mean, I do believe that if we were down there all the time, if there was a cash game all the time in 1-2, I mean, we could totally take $200-$300 out of there every day without a problem.
Yeah, probably.
Absolutely crazy. So I did enjoy that. I did have a pretty big week there. Unbelievable. But to get back to our stuff, I mean, everybody was really happy. I couldn't believe it there. I had never had, especially a week's worth of Annie Up stuff, go by without a complaint from people.
Yeah.
It was exactly. Crazy.
Yeah.
I was very happy.
Really great people. You know, we had some of us invited us up to Louisiana to hang out with them and stuff. So, a lot of fun. And then, of course, everybody's asking about next year's event. I don't know anything about that right now, but as we, always the salespeople down there, I'm like, hey, we've got 7 Annie Up cruises coming up. Join us on one of those. So I'll remind all of our listeners that our next one is October 20th at a New York City going to Bermuda. You have to book by this Monday. That's August 12th to guarantee availability of the $699 per person rate. So go to AnnieUpCruises.com. And just to put a little whisper out there, there might be a completely unofficial Annie Up meetup in Atlantic City on August 22nd.
Wow. Don't forget, too, that this October 20th cruise is we're going to have the team championship on here.
Absolutely.
So even if you're not bringing a team, which would be cool if you did, but even if you're not, you might be able to hook up with another team and get yourself on the cover of our magazine. So all the more reason to book as soon as you can. So go to AnnieUpCruises.com. Hey, the Poker TDA finally released some of those rules, didn't they?
Yeah, you know, they had the summit at the end of June, which you know, I talked about on the show when I was out in Vegas. And then obviously what they do after that is the board gets together and kind of combs through the rules that were approved and try to get some in, you know, rewrites them into the existing rules in a way that makes sense. And then they had a little bit more discussion. So they obviously were ecstatic that Annie Up covered the summit. So they sent me an advanced copy of the new rules, and so I got a story up on AnnieUpMagazine.com and also on our AnnieUp's Facebook page earlier this week. The official rules should be posted at the Poker TDA website, which is PokerTDA.com, by this weekend. So, you know, I had the good old exclusivity there for a couple days, but they're continuing to refine the rules, so I don't know how much exclusivity we really got. But you should have all the new rules up there by definitely by next week when most of the people are probably tuning into the show. So go to the Poker DDA and read them. A lot of changes this year, you know, that I am not going to rehash on the show since we already talked about them before. But, you know, go to the website and read them. And, you know, a lot of refinement, too, I think, was the big thing this year as well, too. There wasn't a couple big rules added, but a lot of it was just kind of clarifying and refining to make things a little more clear for folks. But cool. You know, after the last show, when I went through some of these rules, you know, one of the big discussions at the summit this year was what role the dealer plays in running the game, and not just, you know, dealing, pitching the cards and collecting the bets, but, you know, do they have some kind of responsibility to protect players from making mistakes, you know, folding out a turn or anything like that? And our Missouri ambassador and longtime podcast listener, Dan Manasovsky, sent us Don. The allergies are getting to me. Don wrote us in right after that show, wanted to give us some feedback on it. And somebody go ahead and read what he wrote here. He says, my question is the reasoning around the dealer being unable to explain things to the table without falling into one player to a hand problem. And what he's referring to, part of the discussion was, you know, if a dealer tries to stop somebody from mucking, does that violate one player to a hand? Does the dealer now become an active participant in the hand rather than a passive? And Don says, I see lots of times when the dealer doesn't prompt a player to act when action is on him, instruct to show both cards to show down, or count all bet sizes. It usually falls to some player to ask who has action. Dealer points, and the player to act is surprised they still have cards. Why doesn't the dealer just point to follow the action or announce that the player doesn't make some motion to cut ships or look at cards after 10 or 15 seconds. This is a neutral comment and doesn't suggest an action to the player. The next is when a player turns over the card that makes their hand, the dealer pretends not to see a hand until both cards are shown. This is showdown. Why can't the dealer simply state the rule that both cards must be shown? This just slows the game, and I've never seen anyone lose the hand by mistakenly mucking. Again, this is a neutral statement. The dealer isn't saying to show his hand because he thinks it's a winner. The last one I've never understood. A player makes a bet. Sometimes the dealer will break down the stacks to try to show the value, but doesn't state the amount. This isn't always clear, and you still need to ask the bet amount. It's even worse on an all-in when they don't do anything until you ask. The only advantage here is not counting is if I had no intention of calling for any amount. Why is this on the player to ask instead of just being basic dealer procedures? This is neutral information. If the player placed the bet in a way to appear larger, smaller, dirty stack, etc. than it really was, then this is just keeping the game clean. The other player's cards are the incomplete information part of the game, not the size of the bet. I talked to Don a little bit about this. I definitely don't have a problem with the first two. I think he's right. It's, you know, keeping the action going is not interfering in the game. It's actually helping the game. And I don't know what the proper dealer procedures are, but I don't think that it's a problem for the dealer to continue to, point around the table, or at least when it looks like someone is not thinking. They're just oblivious to that. It's on them to prompt them, hey, do you know the action's on you?
Right.
I don't see a problem with that, do you?
No. He's supposed to control the flow of the game. He's supposed to make sure everything is flowing at an acceptable rate and everything. So, no, I have no problem with that at all. It's not like he's helping the player with his hand, you know, with his decision-making and with his, you know, whatever. That's just, hey, it's your turn to act, or whatever. So, no, I have no problem with that. I do have a problem with a dealer pushing the cards back to somebody who can check in the big blind and not
realize
it. That's the problem. But other than that, no.
And I think that was more the discussion. So I think, you know, some of these things Tom's pointing out probably weren't the root of the discussion, though they might have been part of the discussion. I mean, obviously the next one he mentions, you know, most dealers I play with say, hey, showdown. And then most of them, rightfully so, get agitated when, you know, this whole, you know, TV
just showing them card.
Yeah, four-hour, you go first, oh, what's he have, that kind of stuff. They most of them don't, you know, go for that. And so I don't think that's a problem with most players, and I certainly don't think that telling someone to, a player to show both cards instead of one is causing anybody any problem, because in a tournament, in an all-in, they have to be shown anyhow, so.
Right.
Now, the last one is, I think we're kind of done, is going to have a tough go of it, because, you know, as our good friend Jody Russell often says in Call of the Floor, you know, it is a game of incomplete information, and Don makes the point that the incomplete information part is that the player's cards, not the size of the bet. And I think a ton of players will disagree, and almost every tournament director is going to disagree with that, that it is on the player to understand or to be able to count chips.
Right.
And obviously a player, there are some remedies that's going to help a player do that, and that's, you know, having the dealer instruct the player not to have the dirty stacks, to keep them in, you know, proper size stacks. That was a big discussion at the TDA this year, is you know, trying to encourage people to, you know, stacks of 20 when possible, and to do everything they possibly can to make it easy for possible for another player to count your stack. But, you know, dealer's never going to count somebody else's stack for you. And I understand why people think when it's all in that they should automatically count down the chips and tell you, but that's a huge thing that came out of this that a lot of people are upset that dealers do. They should not be doing that, according to tournament directors, that when you move all in, that is the bet, all in. Now, if you want to know what the exact bet is, then you do need to ask for it. But it slows down the game, I think, is one of the things the tournament directors say. Every time somebody goes in, to sit there and count down the stack and tell you what the bet is.
Right.
You know, if no one has any intention of calling, it's going to go fold, 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 boom, chips go back, and we get another hand out. So it speeds the game up. If the proper procedure was to count down single bet every single time, you're going to lose a ton of hands during the tournament. So that's why they're not going to do it.
Plus, you make a good point about when they do count it down, they always break it down into stacks of five. So then when you finally fold, then he's got to bring the chips back and stack them up again. That takes another, you know, 30, 40 seconds. And that's just terrible. It's just, you're wasting our time. Just, you know what? If that's all in, is all in. And if you need to count, that's one thing. But if he automatically counts it now, he's taking up that much time to break it down to 5, 5, 5, 5, you know, that. And it's just crazy. So I agree there, too. I don't think that it should be an automatic thing. Whether it's giving information or not, you know, it's that's not the point. You're slowing the game down.
Yeah, and even breaking down the chips, I mean, there's a lot of players that are going to snap a dealer's wrist for reaching in it and breaking down their chips when no one is asked.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
You know, if they make it, they say, hey, 10,000, and they put out a bunch of chips, and it's unclear whether they had the 10,000, that's a different story. And that's clarifying, because the bet's already been announced at 10,000. It doesn't matter whether you have one chip in there or 100,000 chips in there, the bet's 10,000. That's a different story, but... You know, if you just push out a stack and don't verbalize anything, it is on your opponents to ask for that count. You know, you don't want to go in there, and that's when they become an active participant in the hand, and they shouldn't. In a way that sounds like it's being helpful, but it's not.
And if you're Scott Long, that's like the biggest play you have in your arsenal, stacking up your chips as high as possible to look as powerful as it is when it's really not. See, so he's taking away your power there, so you can't do that.
Yeah, and related to that, that was a discussion during the TDA about doing these discretionary color-ups, which is kind of a new thing where, you know, tournament directors now have the discretion to go around when chip stacks have gotten out of hand and color-up even when it's not an announced color-up. Obviously, they want to do that fairly to everyone and not just pick on certain people. But, you know, the deal, I mean, the player's problem with that is obviously it is psychological to have more physical chips in front of you.
Right.
Regardless of the denomination. So, you know, if I've got 10,000 units in front of me and I've got 10,000 $1 chips, it's going to look massive. You know, I'm going to have this huge fortress castle in front of me, right?
Yep.
You're not going to want to push on me. But if you bring me a $10,000 chip, you know, you're going to abuse me all day because it looks like I have one chip. You know, it sounds ridiculous, but it really does work. So,
It's true.
All part of the interesting part of this game we love.
All right, don't forget, our story for this is posted on antiupmagazine.com and, of course, our Facebook page, and we'll have a story on it in our magazine as well in our September issue. Okay, our listener spotlight. You know, each week we spotlight a listener who has called our hotline at 813-448-1120 or emailed us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com. And if they haven't won something from us in the past year, just like we do with the Call to Floor or the Hand of the Week, then, you know, we'll send them something really fantastic. This week's sponsor is... J-Design Playing Cards, the official playing cards of Antiup. Check out J-Design's great cards and more at classicplayingcards.com. This comes from Troy Reeb, and he says, guys, my buddies and I love the show. I listen to every Thursday on my way home from work. It's my prelude to our Thursday night game. We have recently added an optional add-on if you haven't rebought during the first hour. Rebuys are cut off at that point. Some guys show up late from time to time, and we invoke a 25-chip penalty for any player not present at the table a half hour after shuffle up and deal. The penalty goes into the pot for each deal until they show. Our debate has been whether a player may have the option to add on if he isn't present. We had one of the guys call in just before the cutoff slash add-on time. He said he was on his way and wanted the add-on. We are at a 50-50 vote on the issue and wanted to put it up for Chris and Scott to make a final ruling for us. Hopefully you guys will not be a split vote as well.
When are we ever split vote?
Never.
We always agree on everything. all right, well, first of all, I want to give a shout-out to Troy. He's from Canal Winchester, another Columbus suburb. So, you know, he's got Ohio blood in him. So have fun at the game tonight, guys. And, you know, when I initially answered to him, I did, on my mind, I confused myself. I was like, you know, hey, in a casino, it doesn't matter when you sit down. You have the option to do whatever add-ons are available to everyone as long as you haven't looked at your... is before your first hand and you haven't looked at your cards yet, right?
Right.
But what they're talking about here is the, you know, at the end of the rebuy period, then you have that optional add-on that everybody gets. And so they have guys like this particular guy who is driving in and on the phone, hey, give me that add-on, and he's not there yet. And I gotta say, I'm gonna rule, yeah, gotta get there on time for that optional add-on. I don't think you could show up after the add-on and all that, because that's essentially money is collected and in a casino. Again, that's how I always kind of look at these home game things. How is this handled in a casino? In a casino, you would not be given that option at that point of the tournament. This is not the initial add-on. This is an add-on after the rebuy period, and I think that's a big difference for me.
Well, what I need to know is this guy going to show up after the add-on period ended? If he is, then
yes,
I have
that's
to,
why he's calling ahead.
Then I have to disagree with you. Here's a couple of reasons why, and I'm sorry, these guys are going to have to still be 50-50.
These guys are going to hate. They're going to have to move on to another podcast to get the answer.
Yeah, it's true, because one, if you, as a home game, are penalizing people for being late, that means that you are accepting that they are there. If you are saying, we're going to keep taking 25 chips from you because we know you're showing up late, but until you get here, you're going to keep paying this penalty, then you are actually acting as if they are already there. So by penalizing him, he's going to need to be able to replenish those chips. And because you're treating him as an entity in that game already, then he should be accorded the ability to be able to pay for any add-on that he wants. If you're penalizing him, then you can't double penalize him. You already are penalizing him for being late, and you're considering him a player in the game. He's in that game, whether he's physically sitting there or not. He's saying that I'm committed to that, my money's there, and I'm on my way. I'm coming, I'm playing. You can't stop me from adding on if you can penalize me for not being there. So you're considering me there, I'm there, I need to be able to get all the benefits of being there, and you know I'm coming. Just because I'm late doesn't mean I'm not there. You know, I'm there, you're taking my stack, you're taking chips from my stack, the stack that I'm going to have to play when I'm there. So it's just like I'm in the bathroom and you're penalizing me. So for me, the fact that you're assuming that I'm going to be there, that you're accepting I'm going to be there, and you're putting me in a tournament and penalizing me for being late, you have to give me the same benefits that everyone else is getting. Otherwise, you shouldn't be able to penalize me. And I think that this guy should be able to get his add-on.
Interesting. All right, so let's say you're in a real licensed casino. You're the tournament director, God help us. You announce, hey, it's the add-on period. If you want the add-on, leave a $20 bill at your stack, and you have to take it before we come around and collect the money. All right? Some dude gets up. You know, he's been there all day. He's got to hit the bathroom, runs to the bathroom, forgets to put his $20 back. What do you do then?
Forgets to put his $20 down, and then he comes back, and it's over?
Yeah.
I think
is that not the same situation?
Well, I don't think it is, because I think that you can go to the Eye in the Sky and they'll know he was in the tournament.
Well, but the guy you're talking about here is in the tournament. His chips are there. He's not physically there, but he's in the tournament, according to your logic.
Well, what I'm saying is that if he hasn't played a hand, I'm saying that you go to the Eye in the Sky to prove that he was already there and he's already playing, if you needed to for some reason. I don't know why, but and that he didn't leave it, but he came back and he wanted it. As long as they didn't deal a hand, they'll still give him the add-on.
Oh my gosh, this is why you would never be a professional tournament director. There are rules in place. You know, you've got to, by the time the tournament starts back up, you will have to have paid your add-on if you want it.
Well, see, you have a very incongruous argument. Your argument is a poor argument. First of all, this guy is calling in and saying, I want it, and I'll pay you when I get there. You're saying another guy is saying nothing at all, leaving the table and then coming back. These are totally different situations. This is a guy who informed them that he wants it.
But what you're saying is, in both situations, these people are already invested in the tournament, so therefore they should be afforded the add-on whenever it is they decide they want it.
No, not whenever they decide they want it. This guy is showing up for the first time to play in the tournament at X. If you're penalizing this guy every single time that it comes around for a deal, then you're accepting him as a regular player. He can't physically give you the buy-in, but you're taking his pips from his stack.
Well, he could physically buy it if he got there on time.
I understand that, but you're accepting that he's going to be able to sit in his tournament. Now, let's put it this way: if the tournament had this, you know, the sign-up registration until 3 o'clock, and somebody shows up at 3:15, you can't let him buy in because that's the rule. But in this home game, they're saying you can buy in if you call in. You can buy in and show up late. So if you're showing up late and you're considering this guy there already, then he's there. And the only thing he has to do is tell you he wants the add-on, because you're not taking his buy-in until he shows up either. So if you're taking his buy-in when he shows up for the stack that he has, you should also be able to take his add-on money for the stack that he wants. There's no reason why you shouldn't give him that money. You can't just take his buy-in money and penalize him for the add-on. He's late for the buy-in, too. It's a totally different situation than already being there and already playing and already paid your buy-in, and then walking away during the add-on period and coming back and saying, oops, I forgot to put my $20 down. This is you've accepted this guy as a player, and you've on faith you said you're going to pay your buy-in. So if you're accepting that, you have to accept the guy saying to you, he physically is telling you, I want the add-on. I'm telling you before the buy-in period's over, and I'll pay it when I get there, just like I'm paying my buy-in when I get there, because he's saying I want a seat in the tournament before I get there. And you're accepting that.
All right. I got you. So here's the thing. We need to make this clear for these guys in our home game, right? So as fun as the debate is, perhaps the solution for these folks is that if you are not there when it starts, you need to call and immediately say, I'm taking the add-on.
Yeah, I mean that...
When it comes to time.
That's what he did, right?
Well, not really. He called a little later saying, hey, I'm still running late, whatever, blah, 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 blah. I guess it's semantics at that point, but perhaps... And really, I had it back and forth with Troy. Really, here's the problem, and this is why it was interesting to me, because I love to see how home game people police their own home games. Because I first thing I asked him is, you know, all right, so it's a 25-chip penalty. Are you also blinding them off? And they're like, yes. So not only are you being blinded off, but you're also getting a 25-chip penalty. And the reason they did it is that tardiness is a big problem in this game.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a way to kind of, you know, punish people for not getting there and making the game go. So two solutions, I think. One, I don't know how many people were in this game. I added this letter down to make it pretty short for the show, but maybe he said. But the new TDA rule is not to deal with dead stacks.
Right.
So obviously these guys are calling saying, hey, I'm going to be there. I'm going to buy them when I get there. I think perhaps the best solution is just to treat them as not being there at all until they show up. I mean, what's the big danger in showing up a little late and then you start with the stack? Now, I guess the problem is it doesn't really help these guys, I guess. I mean, but that's the fairest way to do anything.
Well, you just said that they have a problem with tardiness, so they're trying to keep people from doing that, just showing up late and getting a full stack and not paying blinds and not paying a penalty and... They're trying to keep their home game solid, and these guys keep showing up.
I understand. But here's what I would say, then, is if you're not there by the end of the add-on period, you are not in the tournament, which is your original argument, correct?
Yeah, you're not in the tournament.
And therefore, you're not eligible for the add-on. And actually, at that point, you're not eligible to be even playing at all.
Right, which destroys your home game. See, they're trying to keep their home game
together.
Yeah,
okay, all right.
You're thinking of it as a casino, just like before with your example.
Well, that's always where I start.
But these are buddies who are trying to keep a home game together, and they're upset that their buddies are coming late.
All right, so I'll say this then. If you're not there at the start and you want to be in, you are compelled at that point to do the add-on, whether you call or not.
Isn't
that a better penalty?
So you're forcing them to pay for the add-on.
Forcing them to pay. It's, you know, obviously, maybe I get rid of the chip thing, but, you know, hey, if it's $25 to get in the tournament, you're not there, and the add-on is $25, you're committed for $50 whenever you show up. And you will get the add-on if you show up 10 minutes after the add-on period. You're going to start with the full stack plus the add-on. Paying that $50.
I don't know. I don't think people are going to like that either.
No one's going to like it. That's the problem is that...
Well, I mean, I'd rather pay with chips than cash. You know, these guys would rather pay a 25-chip penalty than $25 out of their pocket. Then you're talking about arguments.
It's 25. It could be 5.
Well, whatever it is. But you're talking about arguments. You're talking about forcing somebody to give you more money if they don't want to give you more money.
All right, are you telling me there's not already arguments in this home game?
Oh, maybe. There might
be. I mean, have we ever done a 25-chip penalty?
But we're not trying to introduce more penalty, more arguments. We're trying to solve the problem they have. You know, if one guy says...
Well, obviously, the problem is here is half the people don't think these players should get the add-on. The other half do. So it is a problem regardless of how we solve it.
Well, here's the deal. I think that we've presented our sides now, and maybe we've presented sides that they haven't. So maybe they should hear what we had to say, and now it might have changed other people's minds, and they could do a revote. And then they may have a vote that doesn't go 50-50 again. Because they may have seen your opinion and thought, oh, that's a good idea. Let's just do the rebuy forced, and then... But even that doesn't really solve the issue because the guy
doesn't. Right.
But you know, on my side, if the guy is getting penalized and he's saying he's playing and you're accepting him as a person, then you have to give him all of the benefits of being there. And one of them is add-on. He's saying he wants the add-on, so let's see what they do. But I don't. You and I aren't going to agree on this, we're not going to be able to.
I mean, I don't think anybody harbored any illusion that we are going to.
Yeah.
Troy. Sorry, Troy. All right, so I would call the floor if you find yourself. in your favorite poker room or home game and not sure what the proper ruling should have been, email us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com, and we'll have our veteran poker room manager, Jody Russell, tell you how he would have ruled. This week's sponsor is TournamentButton.com, which offers a variety of home dealer buttons with timers built right into them. You can customize them with your own photo or logo. And ask about the AntiUp logo version. Use code ANTIUP for free shipping. This comes from Stan S. in Austin, Texas. A great, great city. Have a lot of fun there. Have you been there?
I have not. No, my family was just there, but I didn't go.
Great barbecue. That's cool. Great music, too. And the best scotch bar I've ever been to before. Scotch Flight. Oh, my gosh.
I did hear about the music. They said that the music was remarkable. It was like every night. It was incredible. So, but I didn't go.
All right, this is actually a fairly easy one, but you know, hey, if people write in, that means other people are struggling with it, too. So, here's what Stan said. As the floor, I was stumped by a situation at our weekly home tournament game. They probably wanted to do an add-on, and people wasn't there, you know. Hate that. what he says is, while beginning to deal the flop, the dealer fumbles the deck, and only the second card is exposed. None of the other cards, even the burn, were exposed, and all players agreed that the order of the cards was maintained despite the fumble. And what I think is funny is there's fumbling in Texas.
Yeah, that's funny.
Because Cowboys never fumble.
Yeah, that's funny.
Since substantial action has occurred in the hand, what's the procedure to address this and continue the hand?
Was Leon Lett the dealer? Sorry.
I'm sorry.
I said, was Leon Lett the dealer? Sorry. All right, so Jody says, if I'm reading this correctly, the card exposed is part of the board. If that is the case, there is no problem here. And this is one of those ones where, you know, like somebody gives you a question and you look at it and it's so obvious, but you think it's a trick question because you're staring at this question forever and you're like, it's so obvious. And then you're like, it's answer A. And they're like, yes. And I'm like, oh, okay. Well, I just thought you were trying to trick me, you know. But it's true, the card that was exposed is the board, so it's no big deal, just put it out. Just like in stud, when somebody deals an up card before they deal the real up cards, it's okay, that'll be their up card, just give them a down card next time.
You know? Actually, that's incorrect. I learned that in my last tournament.
When did you get the up card? Was it your first or second hand? Or first or second in the dealer?
If it's pre-flop, you can't, because it could change the bring-in.
Oh.
Yeah, see? That's something I learned. We've been doing that incorrectly for years.
How could it change the bring-in if it's we don't think of cards as being predestined?
Well, that's another argument, but the actual argument, I went and saw the rules after I talked to someone, and it is that if that card was supposed to be down, it should have been up. It changes who brings the bring-in. It's unlike, you know, the blinds are forced blinds.
Yeah.
You get the blinds regardless of what your cards are, but, you know, it could make a difference. If you were not supposed to, it's not a random at that situation. You were supposed to get that card, and that card determines whether you bring it in or not. That's a problem. It's different than a blind.
Uh-oh. Everybody in the home game is going to want a rebate.
I know, isn't it? Fascinating. It's why I love this game. You know, I thought about that when I heard that ruling, and I thought about it, because I actually set up, I'm like, no, it doesn't matter. You just deal it up. And then one of the older players is like, you can do that, but it's incorrect. And wasn't making a big deal out of it, and then someone else said something, and they brought the floor, and he was muttering. He's like, changes to bring in. And so the floor came over, and they explained it. He's like, yeah, absolutely, it's a misdeal. You got to redeal it, because it could change to bring in. Wow. And then I'm like, oh, light bulb went off.
Wow. All right, well, I guess do that in our home game, then.
Yeah. But in this situation, this card was going to be on the board. It didn't matter where on the flop it was going to be. It doesn't matter if the ace is the second card of the flop or not. It doesn't change anything, right?
Right.
So as long as, I mean, one, this dealer should get hired at any room in America, in my opinion.
Because he didn't fumble everything else?
Fumbled the deck and didn't mess anything up. No, that's truly, cool. That's amazing. I mean, we're humans. We're going to make mistakes, right?
Yeah.
That's awesome. I mean, we've got another one, I think, coming up. It's so hard because I do the show notes. Maybe we've already talked about it. I don't think we have another one coming up where the exact opposite of this happens. Man. And that's cool. But this, you know, they fumbled, bounced, got it. Everything's fine. You know? Just because it didn't seem right. It didn't. But.
All right, well, we put you off long enough. We had a little break in the action last week with our trip to the Dominican Republic. So we get to finally complete an O'Malley's move. Let's refresh our memories with part one.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we are seated at a $1, $2, no-limit hold'em cash game. It's been a typical 1-2 game, some maniacs, some solid players, and some rookies. we sit with 175, down about 25. The action is folded around to a solid MP who limps. We get one more call from the cutoff and are in the big blind with the King of Spades, Six of Diamonds. Not a great hand, but it's our option, so we check. The solid MP has us outchipped. He sits with about 300. The flop comes down, the Six of Clubs, Four of Diamonds, Deuce of Clubs. This is a decent flop for our hand. We've got top pair. Unfortunately, we're first to act. With about $7 in the pot, we make it $4 to go. The MP raises us to 15, and the cutoff folds. We toss in a call, with a set or a flush draw firmly in the back of our minds. There's roughly $35 in the pot, and the turn is the King of Diamonds. This card brings mixed emotions with it. If we were way behind, we may have just walked right into a trap. If we're ahead of, say, a flush draw, we've got to protect it. The only problem is, how do we know what to do? We decide to bet this card, and make a $20 stab at the pot. Our opponent raises us to $60. What's the move here?
I really, really hate betting out on this turn.
Yeah.
You know, as O'Malley said, we could be way behind here and just walked into the trap. And so if so, why would we want to poke the bear?
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd much rather have checked the turn. You know, it helps us control the pot if we're behind, which is a possibility. And if we're ahead, it lets us walk the dog. I mean, it's a double advantage for us, I think. But as played, though, I think we have to call here. I don't want to poke the bear again, and our hand is obviously too strong to fold.
You know, it kind of feels like a set, you know, given the way the pre-flop and post-flop play came down. But it really could be a flush draw with, like, pairing that king, you know, the King of Clubs. Otherwise, I felt like he couldn't raise there. And then the other thing is, then I said to myself last that when we were writing this reaction, what hand that has a King of Clubs in it would limp in middle position? So I really feel like we're still ahead here, and I'm going to shove, since I don't think I can fold top two, and calling probably isn't the right play since we'd only have about 100 left in our stack. So I'm probably just going to shove and hope we're not drawing dead, which I don't think we are, because we could still hit another king or a six or whatever. So I'm gonna shove. So let's see what happens.
Hello again. This is why the big blind is such a hard position to play. Not only are you out of position for the entire hand, if you get a piece, but not the best of it, you can really get into a lot of trouble. We've got two pair on a drawy board. There's a lot of danger that comes with this, and we have to put in $40 to win $115. If we just call, it leaves us with roughly $100. If we shove, we may induce a fold, which is what we want anyway. What hands are we losing to? Kings, sixes, fours, deuces, and 5-3. We can out and out eliminate 5-3. There's no way this solid player would have played that in the MP. Furthermore, he would have raised with kings pre-flop from the MP. So, does he have a lower set? It's likely that he does. He would have limped from the MP with sixes or fours, and possibly twos. Ultimately, I think we're ahead of his range. Could it be a flopped flush draw? Perhaps King of Clubs, X of Clubs? That actually makes the most sense. Ultimately, we decide not to make the same mistake we made last episode, and we shove the turn. Our opponent begins agonizing over this decision. Fantastic! We're ahead. Even though we feel like we're winning, we'd like him to just go away. Ultimately, he makes the call and tables the King of Clubs, 10 of Clubs. We don't like this at all. We cringe as the Ace of Clubs hits the river, and we get stacked. But we made the right play. Right? Until next time, I'm Malcolm O'Malley saying, if you get it in good, don't sweat it if it turns out bad. I hope to see you on the felt.
All right, partner, I'm not going to say this often, but I think you made a good point about our stack size, which I forgot. But that is all the more reason I would have checked the turn. You know, I don't think it would have made a difference in this specific hand. Though we would have had an opportunity to fold the river when the flush got there. But overall, I think it's a more sound way to play a decent but not monster hand out of position against a player showing strength, and that's to check this turn and let them let them keep firing and set the price for you.
If he shoves, do you fold if you check the turn?
On the turn?
Yeah, top two.
No, I don't think I'm going to fold.
Then why would you not just shove yourself then? If you're going to call an all-in, why not go all-in and put it on him?
No, but you're talking about two different things. I'm talking about we were first to act and we bet. That's what I'm upset.
No, I asked you if we checked and he shoves, would you call?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's possible that I would, but it's not 100% that I would.
Oh, okay.
It's 100% that I would, then obviously I would shove, but it's certainly not 100%.
Okay.
Because, you know, I mean, we got a great hand, but it's not the best. We very well have a set against us. There's two clubs. You know, you could even have 5-3 and worried about the clubs, and that's a perfectly good way of playing it, is shoving there to protect if he thinks that we're drawing. There's lots of reasons that I could talk myself into folding. Probably wouldn't, but that's no reason for me to shove just because I think I would call, you know.
I like our play.
I mean, what if I check and he bets, you know, what was the action again? I'm looking here. Let's see. We bet 20, raises to 60. If we didn't bet, you know, it was 35 in the pot, you know, what's he going to bet? 30, 35 at the most?
So you're saying if we don't bet 20, he's going to bet like 20 to 35, because only 35.
I would think so, right? Yeah.
Maybe.
I mean, he could shove, too. I mean, you know, it's no limit. He can do what he wants. But the fact that we bet 20 made it easier for him to raise us and commit us to 60.
Yeah.
Whereas if we checked, I really don't think that we would have been calling 60 there.
Well, I, you know, especially since we only had one card to come at that point at the end, I really feel like, even though we found out we were actually ahead and statistically ahead at that point, too, and we only had about $100 left, I really don't think I could have folded there no matter what. I mean, I don't know about on the river, if I had gotten to the river with some money left, but I think he made the right play. I feel like his shove was the right thing to do there. And actually,
I mean, I guess that's the next thing I got to figure out in my line of thinking. If I was going to check call the turn, what am I going to do on the river?
Exactly.
You know, I would think at that point I'd probably have to bet out at that point, but.
And then he shoves on you, and then you.
But it depends on the read. I mean, if he looks, I mean, again, we're talking, it's just a home game. No, this is just a 1-2 no limit cash game. Generally, in a 1-2 no limit cash game, you know, I'm not some. I'm certainly not a spawn of Joe Navarro here. I don't have his massive tell reading abilities, right?
Right.
But I don't think you need to be to that level in a 1-2 to at least get a basic read on a player. And I think, generally speaking, I and most players can get a basic read on a player in a 1-2 on whether we think they're going to bet the river or not based on how they've been betting, you know?
Yeah.
If you get into a tournament or a bigger game, then it's a little different. But, you know, for the most part, I think you know already, hey, this guy's going to bet all the way to the end, or he's trying to push us off, and on the river, then he's going to check behind. We don't want that, obviously. So, I mean, I would probably bet out. I mean, really, what's the difference in check calling on the turn and then betting out on the river versus check betting out on the turn and calling the race, you know? You're just delaying it a little bit and probably saving yourself some money if you're behind.
Yeah, it's another thing about not having position. Just every
it's
week, every problem anybody ever usually has in one of these things is because they don't have position, and just another reason to try to minimize the decisions you have to make. And
exactly,
yeah, tough hand.
Hey, this is Hort Corkins, and I'm listening to Annie Up.
It's time for Hand of the Week. Send your hands or situations to podcast@antiupmagazine.com. This week's sponsor is Smapsoft, creator of the Chinese 13-card poker app for Apple products. Download the Apple app today by visiting the iTunes store. This one comes from across the pond, I believe. Actually, it's not across the pond. I just know he's playing online, and he says, my apologies to Americans who still can't play Scoop.
Yeah, we were watching players in the Dominican Republic playing in the poker room on their laptops and Poker Stars, and we were like,
you know, it's like they'd seen the Three Amigos where they all have the canteens.
Yeah.
And one of them's getting a trickle of water, the next one has sand, and then Dusty Rhodes, his waters fall everywhere, he throws it on the ground and just drips all over the place. That's exactly the same feeling, I think.
Yep. Right?
All right, so anyhow, I don't know if he's across the pond, but he's clearly outside the U.S. border and fat and happy playing his online poker. It comes from Eric. And he was playing in, obviously, the PokerStars Scoop. And so it's a little bit of a situation. So, but we'll play through as a hand of the week and then talk about it. So this is a, it looks like a $27 tournament. We're in level 5, which is 6120. Six max, so six players to the table. Chip stacks range from 7,100 to about 26,000. And we are second, looks like third lowest. We got 99.60 in chips. Okay. And we are under the gun. There's also a 15 chip ante at this point, too. And we are dealt the ace of clubs, four of clubs, under the gun, first act. What do you do?
If I say muck, is the hand of the week over?
It could be.
I'm mucking this hand, I think. I mean, if it's kind of a passive table, I might limp, you know? But it's so obvious what hand you have if two clubs come on the board and you're playing the hand. You know what I mean? It's just weird. So, I mean, if it's a passive table, and I don't know that now, so I can't. So I have to give two scenarios. But if it was a real aggressive table where guys are going to raise and re-raise and put me to, you know, I have to be in the middle of something because it's the kind of table it is, and I'm under the gun, I'm probably just going to let this go. You know, it only makes it a little bit better because it's suited. I mean, it's not that big of a deal. And what's inevitably going to happen is you're not going to get any clubs, but you're going to hit an ace, or it's going to come four high, and you're going to think your hand's good, and somebody's going to have pocket eights, and you're going to lose a bunch for no reason. So I'm just trying to minimize the decisions I have to make. So if it's a passive table, I'd probably limp and try to make the flush and be, you know, diligent with that and stick to it. And then if I flop two pair or something. But other than that, you know, I'm not going to get too involved if I flop four high, you know, a four high pair or something, or a pair of aces. So I think I would fold it if it's a real aggressive table, and if it was real passive, I would limp. But I don't see myself raising with this hand because then inevitably, you know, someone's going to re-raise, or they're going to put me on something like ace-king, and then the board's going to come all rags, and they're going to raise me, and then I'm going to be stuck in this position where I need to make a decision for no reason. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you two scenarios since I don't know how this table plays.
Well, what's interesting about that is, you know, I wrote back a long response to Eric, and then before I got ready to send, I'm like, this is six-handed. It's a six-max tournament.
Yeah.
Because initially I'm like, there's no way I'm playing ace four suited under the gun in a tournament.
Right.
Well, not no way, but generally speaking, I'm not going to. But you know, it's six max, and back when I had the enjoyment of playing online, I really preferred the six max tables. For some reason, I think what it did for me was it made me more aggressive, which is my biggest problem in No Limit, is I'm not aggressive enough, and because it's six handed, it almost has a limit feel to me. You know, like we're playing limit in our home game. So I tend to be more aggressive, and I do better, and it's because I'm more aggressive, I think, is the way I've, you know, jumbled into my brain, right?
Okay.
So knowing that, and then looking at the chip stacks, and we are like, what, second or third?
From the
third in chips, yeah. And then the chip leader is quite a bit more than us. But we have 83 big blinds right now. I don't think we can continue. I think playing too passively in a six max, particularly when you're deep stacked, is not the proper play. So you know, I'm not playing this to hit my clubs or a couple fours or an ace or anything here. I'm just playing my position, my under the gun, and putting in a raise in there and assuming that some other players are going to fold, and then be able to bet out on most flops and try to take it down then. And obviously, there's a lot of things that can happen in this hand. But I've got a hand here that could flop huge. And I'm going to take that as an opportunity, as one of those rare times to raise, to make myself look more aggressive than I really am.
Okay, so let me ask you this. So you're saying that you're going to raise with this, right?
Right.
If you were playing in, let's say, a 10-person seated table.
Uh-huh.
And it went fold, 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 and it got to you. You would still raise with ace four?
On the button, absolutely. Cut off, absolutely. Hijack, depending on the rest of the table, how the table's played.
Right, but those aren't the seats that I'm telling you about. If it's 10-handed and it went fold, 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 now it's on you, and you have ace four, you're raising with it?
Yeah, well, it's see, I've never really bought this argument that you take a 10-handed and you take the first four seats off, and that's how you play. I know other people do, but I don't really think. I mean, here, we are under the gun, and under the gun signifies something in people's minds. You know, whether it's four-handed, six-handed, or 27-handed, when you're raising under the gun, you're showing strength.
Okay, well, you're stating that like it's fact.
I'm not stating it like fact. I'm just stating it that that's what people perceive it as different. It's different than a middle position raise in a 10-handed, even if you are, you know, the sixth person or whatever it is.
Well, all right, but just answer
psychologically,
my question,
it's slightly different.
But would you raise?
Is it drastically different? No, but it's slightly different.
Would you raise if it was 10-handed and four folded to you and you had ace four clubs? Or would you fold?
I would consider it, yes.
Okay. Well, every poker book I've ever read that talks about six-handed play says that that's the way you need to treat it, that you're actually that far in, because it's the cards behind you that matter, not the cards that were ahead of you. If they're all gone.
I'm not picking on any author because they are smarter than me, but I also think it's a quick, easy shorthand thing for a book that people take away from it. That I don't think really is completely correct. Again, that's an opinion.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's correct. I'm just saying that's how I've been.
It's a good way of thinking about it. But
yeah.
Again, do you not think that the under the gun position holds a little bit about extra power?
No, only in a 10-handed table I do. I think that in a 6-handed table they're thinking like you. You're just saying it's ace four is powerful now. So I'm going to play it. So
I'm
they're
not
all giving
it's
that same.
At all. I think
well,
it's
a
hand
that you can raise with. You're saying.
I just think it's a hand that has a lot of potential. If I had seven deuce here, I'm not raising under the gun just because it's under the gun and it's six max. This is a hand that you know I can flop a flush and totally stack someone. I'd rather flop a wheel here. It would be amazing, or and try to. This is a hand that I can stack a player with, and if but that's not my approach here. My approach is to show myself as an aggressive player, and this is a hand that helps me randomize that by raising under the gun, which I wouldn't normally do, most people wouldn't normally do, but I have the added protection of it being a hand that could flop big and pay off for me, but in my mind, obviously I know my plan in this hand is to fire again on the flop and take it down regardless of the flop is, unless it's crazy dangerous.
But why does all of that change because it's six-handed? All of those little axioms you just put in there were all true, even if it was 10-handed. You're still got a hand that can flop big. You still have a hand that could...
Right.
But you wouldn't have done all that. You'd
the only difference
the
is in 6-max is you have to be more aggressive. I don't think you have to be more aggressive in 10-handed or 9-handed. It's definitely an advantage to be, but I don't think you have to be. In 6-handed, if you play your normal... a passive ABC game, you're going to get eaten up in 6-max.
Okay,
everybody
well,
else is going to be more active. So you have to find a way to become more active. So this is the whole Dan Harrington looking down at your watch. If it's, you know, on the 10-second hand you raise, if it's on the 40-second hand you call thing. This is another one of my little things that I do to randomize it a little bit.
But the other thing then is I feel like a little bit that you're contradicting yourself then, because you're also
saying... Sure I am. I always do.
Well, you're saying under the gun has this sort of aura of it, but yet we all know we're playing six-handed and we all know we have to be aggressive.
No, again, I mean, this is the same thing as shoving as betting 59 rather than 60, all right? Yeah. Realistically, yeah, we all should know that there's no difference between a bet of 59 and 60, all right? But it looks bigger because of the extra chips. It's the same thing here. It's, yeah, all the rational, reasonable poker players at the table realize we're playing six max and it's really not under the gun. But every once in a while, some people forget, or there are some people at the table that don't. It's not this massive. I haven't cracked the Da Vinci poker code here with this. I'm just saying it's got a little extra something something, and you should take advantage of it.
All right, so you're going to raise it.
Again, I this whole thing started by me writing this email saying no, I would have folded from the beginning.
Right, but then you thought it was 6-max,
and it's 6-max, and I can justify it. So yeah, I'm fine with them raising. I'm fine with them folding too. I'm not saying you have to raise here, but I think this is a hand, particularly if you are a player that is not as aggressive as you should be. This is a good time to take a shot at being a little bit more aggressive and mixing up your holdings a little bit.
Okay.
if you lose and you get a showdown, then you're showing some people that you're a wild and crazy guy when you're not. So it's got some advertising potential as well.
I just wish I knew what the table was like. You know what I mean? I wish I knew that.
You always wish we knew what the table was like.
Right, but we should usually get that information beforehand. How can you react if you don't know what the table is like? So if you don't know, I'm going to take a passive line here and fold it or limp. But if I knew it was really aggressive, I mean, if it was really, really aggressive, I might have to raise with it because that's the way everyone's playing everything. So you might have to raise with it. But if it's one of those middle-of-the-road, middling kind of aggressive tables, then I may just let it go. Just really would help if we knew. But all right, so what happens?
Okay, he raises 180 to 300.
Okay.
So about two and a half big blinds. Two folds, and looks like the button calls for 300.
Okay.
Make sure that's right. You hit the button. Yeah, I'm not good at counting, as you know. All right, so two-handed. Flop is ace of diamonds. Four of spades, eight of spades, you knew it would be. And we are first to act.
Well, there's, 700 or so in the pot now? Maybe almost 800 because of what the blinds are called. So,
yeah, we got the antes.
And so. we got top and bottom pair, which is pretty huge, six-handed.
Six-handed, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and the ante, so you're looking at a good 800. So I have, and there's a flush draw and a wheel draw, which I don't think a wheel draw is a threat here, but a flush draw could be a threat here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, if I knew the guy was the type of player that would, you know, would think that if I check its weakness and he might bet out or whatever, I might consider a check raise because I can afford to here. If I think this guy is, you know, middle-of-the-road ABC type player, then I'm just going to bet to say, hey, I'm continuation betting. And if I think he may raise me, I might let him raise me and then re-raise him again. So it really depends on this player. I have no information about this player, what I would do.
The only information I can give you, and it may be important, I don't know if it is right now, but he is one of the players that does have us covered.
Okay, he has us covered. I'm likely going to bet out here. I'm under the gun, which, you know, has this aura.
Massive!
Yeah.
The aura!
Yeah, and I raised pre-flop, so I'm showing strength. And then the ace comes. It looks kind of fishy to me if I don't bet here.
Yeah, I think you check it, you kill so much value in this hand. Because one, most players aren't going to believe that you missed this slot.
Right.
They're going to be at six max, you raised under the gun. What possibly could you have that you're not worth betting here? And then if you check raise, as you mentioned, then you've just killed the hand at that point.
Yeah.
Because then they're like, okay, you got me, and fold, and you're done. And I need to get more value out of this hand. I mean, this was great. This is exactly what I was talking about. I was looking just to bet any flop, and I actually hit this flop. I wouldn't normally get too excited about top and bottom pair, but six-handed in this situation, this is beautiful.
Yeah.
So I'm going to bet out again and hope I get raised.
Yeah, I think...
So I should get raised more often than not, I would think.
We're hoping he's got something like ace-jack or something.
Yeah.
You know, and then obviously doesn't pair that card, but...
Or really anything. I mean, I would think most players in this situation would raise us here just to find out what we really have.
Well,
obviously, I'm not excited about the ace with an under-the-gun player, but again, if I got kings, queens, jacks, any of that stuff, I'm still betting this flop, and then if someone raises me, then they put me to a test. So, I mean, particularly if this guy has me called, I mean, it doesn't have to be a huge raise, but, I'd put in maybe, I'd probably raise us to 1,500.
Okay, so we're going to bet probably like 600.
Sounds about right.
Right, you know, it's 800 in the pot or so, two thirds or so. So,
yep.
I don't have a problem betting about that much. And what's going to inevitably happen here is like the board's going to pair, and it's going to be like an eight, and our two pair is going to suck, and we're going to lose a kicker or something. I just know it. But really, I like our hand right now, and I'm going to continuation bet. I'm going to make it look like I hit this flop, which I did, but you know, or I'm going to make it look like I'm pretending to hit this flop. I don't see this guy wants to bluff me, so I'm going to bet.
Okay. That's exactly what he does. He bets 600, and our opponent calls.
Okay.
The turn is the nine of hearts. So our board now is ace of diamonds, four of spades, eight of spades, nine of hearts. So flush doesn't get there, or our two pair doesn't make compromised. Straight draw out there, which is probably inconsequential at this point.
Yeah. I'm going to keep betting. The only reason why I wouldn't bet is if I was convinced he had a set or ace 8 or ace 9, and I can't be convinced of that at this point.
Yeah.
So I'm going to bet like 1,500. I mean, the pot's got to be around 2,000 now, so I'll bet around 1,500 or so.
Okay.
1,300, 1,500, something like that.
He bets 1,320.
Okay.
Seems worth it. And is raised to 44.55.
Well, I have two pair. The pros always say don't go bust unless you have at least two pair. So, I just don't know if I could let this go right now. I've got 1,300. 600, that's 19, and then 3. I've got 2 grand of my set 99 invested in this hand. I don't think I can fold top and bottom pair here. You know, I mean, this guy could have ace 9. He could have hit ace 9 there, and we're screwed. You know, drawn just to 4s, but I don't know if I can call. Can I call? Because then, you know, you're going to call, and then you're going to check the river.
Yeah, I do remember having a discussion on this hand.
So right?
I totally can call here. I know you can. Most players can't.
Well, because I think of the next street. What do I do on the next street if it comes?
Right. And it's probably going to go into the next street, but why commit yourself right now when you have the option on the next street to stay in the tournament and save yourself 4,500 units, which is still
right. Plenty. I'm saying you could fold. I'm trying to figure out if I need to fold or shove.
Yeah, but I mean, I could call here as well, too. I mean, I could fold on the river if I want to fold. I mean, we got 2 pair right now.
Well, you're calling 50% of your stack then.
I understand. But again, if I call and fold on the river, and I'm not saying I am,
right?
We would have 45. Let me do the math here quick. We would have 38 big blinds left. That's plenty of poker for me. Versus just wildly shoving here against when we very well could be behind. Just because we have 50% of our stack in the pot. That never makes any sense to me. Never has, and I know everybody on the show knows it never makes sense to me.
Well, in your mind, do you think this guy could be making a move on you, too?
Oh, yeah, absolutely could be making a move.
He's floating you and thinking that he doesn't believe
you. But right now, here's the thing, is he's going to have to make 2 moves on me if he's making a move on me. If I call now and check the river, and I'm not saying I'm going to check the river. I could bet out of the river. Who knows? But if I check the river, he's going to have to put me all in again to try to win this pot if he's making a move on me. And I think it's a little dangerous. I mean, a lot of players probably would do it, but that's dangerous. If I raise him all in right now, obviously if he has nothing, he's going to fold, right? But if he has something, then I'm probably sunk here, right? I mean, it's tough to imagine he has a worse hand than us right now. If he has something.
Well, a couple of things. One, I mean, by
the only
that
thing
logic...
worse than us right now is...
Why are you betting at all, then, by that logic? Why would you bet at all on that turn? Why don't you just check call the rest of the way?
If he's on a flush draw now, I'm betting he's not gonna call a 4,500 on a flush draw at this point.
Yeah, but he would raise you on a flush draw. Now he's put you to the folding master that you are. You know what I mean? You're not in any chance at all to win.
I'm not giving up control of this hand. There's a lot of reasons that he could fold here. And he could call. I don't mind if he calls. It's only if he raises that I'm put to a little bit of a test, and in my mind, I'm fine with the test. I'm going to call his raise, and I still got 38 big blinds that I can decide what I want to do with on the river. A lot of things can happen on the river.
Okay, well, the other thing I want to say is that regardless of how many blinds you'll have, to me, and every person who's ever taught us anything about poker, and I think you've even been victim of saying this yourself on the show, if you're going to call 50% of your stack, then... you need to just shove. You're 50% of your stack. You're giving up half your stack on a call that you're thinking about folding on the river.
I'm not thinking about folding. I'm leaving the option open to fold. If I go all in here, I've taken that option away from me.
But you've already committed.
It doesn't 50%. Really matter. I mean, if it goes in on the river, why is it? The only advantage to going all in right now is if the guy has absolutely nothing and he's making a move on us, and that's a pretty big gamble. Because, the risk is if I just call that he could actually hit something. Let's say he has a pair now and, I don't know, he's got an ace-jack or something. And he can hit his jack on the river. That's the only risk in that. Otherwise, if he has nothing, he's going to fold if we go all in. But if he has something, he's obviously going to call. And if he has something, his something is almost certainly better than our something right now.
Hey, let me ask you a question. This is hypothetical. If we were playing Limit Hold'em here, and you bet and he raised, what would you have done?
Raised.
Called? Or you would have raised again, right?
Yeah. But I'm not going to be out of the tournament for that.
I'm just curious about what you were thinking here.
Yeah. No, I think, I do think we have the best hand here. I do think he's probably making a move on us. The problem is, and this is the problem with no limit versus limit, is if we're wrong, we are out of this tournament. So why commit another? I understand what you're saying. We've already got 50% of our stack in here. And by the way, I'm going to pause and say that I didn't think this hand was going to take this long, and I love the fact that it is. I totally understand that the argument that you have 50% of your stack in there. But again, I ultimately am thinking about survival here. And this is not my standard Scott Long, I still got 10, 12 big blinds, and I can play with that. I've got 38 big blinds. If I end up folding, and again, I'm not saying I am, that's plenty of play. Plenty of play to get back in this tournament. So I don't think I just want to gamble another 4,500 chips that I think this guy's making a move on me. Doesn't make any sense to me.
So why call at all then? Why not have 76?
Oh, because there's an equal chance that we got the best hand. And let's say if he has nothing, that's what I'm saying. If he has nothing, obviously, and we know he has nothing, the best move is to go all in because he's got a fold. He can't call, right? But even if he does have nothing, if we call, that doesn't mean we're going to lose this hand. It means, again, that if, and it's a big if, we decide to check the river, he's got to make yet another move on us. My experience is a lot of players will make that one move saying, I think he's got nothing, I'm going to get him off, and then, he called? All right, I guess he's not going to go anywhere. Now, I got to make that move on the river. Now, what's interesting is I think I don't remember the particulars, but we had this discussion down in the Dominican about something similar to this, and now I lost it already, but...
Well, you're thinking that this guy, if he's capable of making this move on the turn, you're taking the odds that he's not capable of making it again on the river when you inevitably check, and he can't win the hand because he was on a draw or on a bluff.
Yeah, and that's where the argument was in Dominican, because I folded a hand at some point, and you're like, Scott, there's no way you... I mean, I didn't fold, I'd check behind. Mm-hmm. You're like, Scott, there's no way you're going to win that hand. And I'm like, yeah, I know there's no way I'm going to win that hand, but the chips to me are more valuable saving them than putting him in on a bluff hoping to get the guy to fold. And I totally understand the argument. If the only way you can win is to bet, you should bet.
Right.
But I think it all there's chip management considerations in there, and that's the same thing here. I mean, if this guy, again, this guy has us covered, right? But if he makes that second bluff on the river and is wrong, and we call him, we would have taken him from 12,000 down to 3,000. And that's a pretty big low to his stack. So the same reason thinking that we're thinking that we've got half our stack in, so we got to get it in, I think is working against our opponent if he's got nothing. It's like, can I really, even though I can't win by checking behind here, do I really want to put in another 5,000 to have this guy, you know, do a hero call and knock me down to 3,000? I'd be better off saving that 4,500 plus by 3 and having 7,000 and having 80 big blinds, right?
Well, the other thing then is that you're giving yourself attributes that you can't give this other guy. You're not letting this other guy have 3,000 at the end and saying, it's okay, I can still come back from 28 big blinds. You're saying it's not okay for him to think that way, but it's only okay for you
I'm
to
not
think
saying that. I'm just
well,
saying.
Well, you are. You're saying that he
I'm
can't make a
to
move.
You, and you can't. You would be devastated with that, and I'm going to say 75% of our listening audience would be devastated with that. So I'm playing the odds that he's one of you guys and not one of me.
Well, I feel like this guy could easily, if he's making a move here, he's making a move on the end. Unless something gets that scares the hell out of him, like another ace, he's going to make that move to win this pot. He seems like anybody's going to raise there. If they're making a move, they're going to make that move again. Because there's no reason to make that move.
That's
now
the difference
much.
Between you and me. I just don't think that people are going to make two moves.
And I can't,
but that's only part of the argument, too. So you're willing just to throw all your chips in here. Okay, let me do this. Let's play Gundam Rant Binary Bunch here. What odds are you giving yourself on having the best hand versus being way behind here?
More than 50%.
Or being behind at all. Okay, so you think there's a 50% chance that you're ahead.
More than 50. I'm probably like 60-40, maybe 60, maybe okay. Even more. I mean, it feels like this guy could be making a move.
He could be. I'm not saying he couldn't be, but you're willing to put your tournament of life on 60-40?
With one card to come, probably. Probably. I'm not willing to call, Scott. That's the thing. I'm thinking about folding or raising all in. I can't fold. I can't just call 50% of my stack for no reason. But I could call. I mean, I could.
It's not 50% of your stack. It's 4,400 units.
No, at this point, you've made bet 1,320, you've bet 600, and you've bet 300. That's 900.
All right, now, yes, mathematically, it's
what I have left, it's 50% of what I'm
saying is, I think you're getting fixated on being half your stack and not what the actual units are. What if we had, if you had 3 million units right now? And you committed 1.5 million units, and the blinds are 6,120. Are you really thinking, oh my gosh, half my stack's in, I got to put the rest in? That's ridiculous, isn't it?
I just can't call 50% of my stack off. I can't call 50% of my stack.
Oh my gosh.
I just can't.
All right. Okay, that's fine. I'm glad there's players like you out there.
Okay. Well, like I said, I just can't.
50% of stack, it doesn't mean anything. It's the actual number, the amount of the chips is what main. If I'm calling off 50%, if I got four chips and I put two in the pot, it's massively different than if I have 3 million units and I've already had 1.5 million in there. Isn't it?
You know, I know what you're saying.
Admit that there's some difference there, right?
I know what you're saying. You're using the blind level as your defense, not.
It's not my defense. I'm just saying the 50% is a good rule of thumb, but you have to apply it to what makes sense in the specific situation. And we're somewhere in between those two radically crazy ideas I just gave you. But, you know, to me, yes, it's 50% of my stack. I get that argument, but I still have a massive stack if I'm wrong. According to the blinds right now, I've still got 40 big blinds. That's plenty of poker. It doesn't matter that I have 50% in. I feel like, oh, I got 50% in, so I can put 15% more in. I mean, we're in level 5 of this tournament. I don't know how many people are in this thing. But it's a scoop event, so probably, what, 49,000? You know, what's the advantage at level 5 in a tournament with 6 gazillion players of having 18,000 units versus 4,000 units versus being out of the tournament?
Well,
That's the other way you got to look at it.
Other thing too, then, though, is if you're going to
use late in the tournament, then that's a bigger deal.
If you're going to use that as a defense, though, saying that I still have plenty of chips left with 3,000 or 4,000, then there's no reason why this guy can't make the move on the end, and you're going to have to fold anyway and lose that for nothing because he's going to have 3,000 or 4,000.
Well, I could call. I'm probably giving myself the same odds that you are that I'm good here. It's very likely I could call his second bluff on the river and win this thing. I'm not saying I'm going to fold. I'm leaving the option open. I'm not committing myself without knowing what the rest of the card is. A four could come, an ace could come, and, you know, then I'm fine letting him bluff into me if I don't, you know, bet into him. Lots of capping, but why am I committing my chips now before I know the rest of the hand when I don't have to?
So you would call.
The only advantage is if he has a worse hand than me, and I'm going to get him to fold here. That's the only advantage to, I think, to shoving our chips in right now. Because even if he calls, I know some of the people out there are like, "Well, Scott, you need to maximize value. You know, even if he's weaker than you right now, he's got 8-9 or something. You want to get his chips in now? You might not get his chips in on the river." I get that, but again, it's level 5 of this tournament. At this point, the amount of chips in our stack is drastically less important to me than being out of the tournament. We got plenty of time. These chip stacks right now, I'm looking at right now what everybody has, 7,700, 26,000, 12,000. These are meaningless, for the most part, this early in the tournament. You take these same 6 players, level 10, and I bet you could just cut the chips and move them around by different players' names. It's just too early in the tournament to get so stoked about this versus being out of the tournament.
Okay, I'm either folding or raising. I'm not calling, so I'm going to shove.
Okay. Well, that's what our hero does, so we'll move on right here. So
okay.
All right, so he shoves for his last 9,000. Of course, our hero obviously calls because he had something. I knew it. I saw it. I don't know why you guys couldn't. Actually, I don't know what he has, but he calls. And the river is the Trey of Spades, so our final board is Ace of Diamonds, Four of Spades, Eight of Spades, Nine of Hearts, Three of Spades. We, of course, table our Ace Four for two pair, and our opponent turns over Ace of Spades, King of Spades.
Nice.
Rivers of Flush.
Yay.
Knocks us out of the tournament.
Yay. So, by your standards, then, you would have called, that would have come, and then you would have checked fold.
I would probably have been out of this tournament as well, too. You know, I don't think on... It's hard to put him on a flush draw. It was one of the hands, so, you know, on the end, I would probably be enticed at that point. One, because the amount of chips are in there. Two, that it was a tray, so my two pair didn't get counterfeited, which is what I'd be more worried about than the flush, I think.
Right.
I probably would have called it all in and been out of it, too. But, you know, let's say if it was, well, I don't know. We could do all ifs and for the rest of the night, but doesn't really change anything. We're all sitting here at the bar talking about how we get knocked out of this hand right now.
What's really shocking is, one, that he didn't re-raise with Ace of Spades, King of Spades, in a six-handed hand.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? That's shocking.
And then
he doesn't raise the flop when he crushes it, which is deceiving. I mean, that's cool. That's the way you need to be, I think. I think you need to just set him up for that. So he's played it exactly the way he's supposed to play it. And I guess I can call an all-in if I have that hand at that turn, because that's, you know, you have top pair, top kicker, nut flush draw, and a card to come, and you're still going to be in the tournament even if you lose. So
yeah, at that point, I think he's got to put us on. The only hand I think he can put us on that he's really truly worried about is pocket aces, and
right,
that's pretty unlikely, because it would have to be the, you know, the case aces.
Oops.
You know, yeah. Otherwise, you know, we could be making that move with... Well, as I said at the beginning of the hand, we could be making that move with any couple cards to begin with. But even if we have a legitimate hand, it could be ace-queen, ace-jack. Even if it's a two-pair like we had, we have the flush-outs at that point.
Yeah.
And we wouldn't have been out of the tournament, so, you know, that's another way of looking at it.
Yeah.
You know? So,
interesting hand. I had no idea this hand was going to take this long.
No, that's what I said. I mean, I almost... Eric, I gotta tell you, buddy, I almost thought about just not even putting it on the show. But we'll throw it on there just in case. And it turned out to be very fascinating. So,
all right. Well, it's good to be back in the United States, and good to be eating normal food again. I'm Chris Cassetta.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.